Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine the world of work, as this huge, constantly shifting landscape. For decades, the map seemed pretty clear. Get the degree, land the job. Simple. But what if that map is, rapidly becoming obsolete? We're really seeing this seismic shift where what you know, and crucially what you can do, is starting to matter a whole lot more than, say, where you learned it. Have you noticed how fast job demands change these days? Or how hard it sometimes is to find the right people, the right talent? Well, that's exactly what we're digging into today, this global move towards a skills-first economy.
It's a fascinating evolution, it really is, and it's driven by these incredibly powerful global currents, things like the sheer speed of digital transformation, the urgent push for sustainability, green jobs, and also significant demographic shifts that are reshaping workforces everywhere. These forces are fundamentally challenging those traditional hiring models, the ones that relied so heavily on formal credentials, on degrees. So for this deep dive, we've pulled key insights from two really significant OECD reports. One's called Empowering the Workforce in the Context of a Skills-First Approach, and the other is Advancing Adult Skills Through Individual Learning Accounts.
Okay, so our mission today, then, is to explore how this massive shift is reshaping pretty much everything, corporate learning, coaching, workforce development more broadly. But here's the thing, the real kicker from these reports, just giving people access to learning, it isn't enough, not by a long shot. The real challenge, and what we want to focus on, is making that learning truly meaningful, adaptable, and maybe most importantly, outcome-driven. Does it actually lead somewhere?
Exactly. And that really forces us to ask, how do we actually design, deliver, and support learning in a way that genuinely empowers individuals in this new skills-focused world? Think of this deep dive as a kind of practical roadmap for you, whether you're, say, a trainer, an HR leader, maybe a learning provider, or honestly, just someone curious about staying ahead in your own career. We want to show how this global learning policy stuff can actually translate into practical transformation on the ground.
So let's start with the why. Why is this happening now? The first OECD report, Empowering the Workforce, it really drills down into the powerful forces driving this skills-first shift. It's like a convergence of these huge interconnected changes.
Take the digital transition, for example. It's not just demanding new technical skills, coding and whatnot. It's also about these crucial transversal skills, things like analytical thinking, resilience, flexibility, the softer skills. And even before ChatGPT became like a household name, the demand for digital skills was already projected to grow by something like 70% by 2030. Generative AI has just poured fuel on that fire. We're seeing job vacancies now in roles heavily exposed to AI that critically demand management skills, sophisticated business process understanding, things beyond just the tech itself.
And that connects right into the green transition, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This isn't just, an environmental thing. It's a massive economic reshuffling. Industries like renewable energy, sustainable practices, they're booming. Meanwhile, traditional sectors are seeing declines. And this creates a significant, really urgent skills gap. Get this. In 2023, only a tiny fraction, like 13% of the global workforce, had the skills needed for green jobs, even as postings for these roles just skyrocketed.
Wow, 13%. That's tiny. And it's not just about what skills are needed, but who is actually available to fill those roles, right? Demographics play a huge part.
A huge part. Demographic shifts are compounding labor shortages in many developed countries. You have older workers retiring faster than younger ones are entering the workforce, especially in highly specialized fields. This scenario really underscores the urgent need for a skills-first approach and for rapid, targeted upskilling and reskilling. It's almost like the talent pipeline is shrinking while the demand is just exploding. In some countries, the proportion of employers struggling to fill jobs because they can't find the talent has actually doubled in the last decade. It's quadrupled in places like Ireland, Spain, and the UK.
Quadrupled, that's incredible pressure. So how are employers actually responding to this?
Well, what's truly fascinating is seeing this fundamental shift in emphasis away from where you learn towards what you actually know. Many companies are actively removing degree requirements from job ads just to cast a wider net. Think about a company like IBM, for instance. They've significantly reduced their reliance on traditional degrees. Instead, they're focusing on candidates' practical skills in areas like cloud computing, AI, often validated through their own internal digital badge programs.
Okay, so this isn't just theory or something only tech giants are doing. It's happening in practice, even within government.
Yes, absolutely. States across the U.S., places like Maryland, Colorado, Pennsylvania, they're leading by example, eliminating degree requirements for loads of public service positions. And the early results seem promising. Reports are suggesting reduced vacancy rates and, crucially, increased applicant numbers.
So it genuinely broadens the talent pool. It opens up opportunities for people who might not have the formal piece of paper, but absolutely have the necessary skills. It's about recognizing talent wherever it is.
Exactly. It sounds like a universal win, right?
Yeah.
But it does beg the question, are there any potential downsides or complexities?
Okay. Good point.
Well, the report does highlight that a skills-first approach isn't without its challenges. If it's not implemented really carefully, there's a risk of perpetuating or even amplifying existing biases, especially if the digital tools used for assessment aren't designed impartially. That's a big one.
Right. The tech isn't neutral.
No. And there's also the concern that focusing too narrowly on immediate job-specific skills could unintentionally reduce long-term workforce adaptability. You know, people learn one thing but can't pivot later. And there's delicate balance, too. Moving away from traditional job classifications might impact worker protections, because often employment rights and regulations are tied to those formal qualifications.
That's a really critical point. It's not just about opening doors, but making sure those doors lead to fair, sustainable careers.
Mm.
Which brings us nicely to individual learning accounts, or ILAs. That's the focus of the second OECD report, right? Advancing adult skills through individual learning accounts. They seem like a crucial policy tool here.
Indeed. Think of ILAs as kind of personal virtual savings accounts, but specifically for training. Instead of money, you accumulate training rights over time. Their defining feature is really placing the individual firmly at the center of their lifelong learning journey.
Okay, so unlike traditional company training.
Exactly. Unlike traditional workplace training, which is often tied to your specific employer, these ILA training rights are owned by the individual. You can access them without needing your boss's approval. And critically, they stay with you, the learner, even if you change jobs or become unemployed or self-employed. This portability is key for continuous upskilling in today's dynamic market. It's your account, your learning, your future.
So it really is about empowering the individual, giving them autonomy to choose their own learning paths. And presumably, this helps expand access to learning for groups often left out of traditional funding, like you mentioned, self-employed people, gig workers, maybe employees in smaller businesses that don't have big training budgets.
Precisely. But as we touched on earlier, just providing that access, that funding, isn't the whole story. The real challenge is ensuring the learning is actually meaningful and effective. It's not just about having a wallet full of training credits, is it? It's about knowing what to spend them on and knowing that the course you choose actually delivers value.
Right. So how do these ILA systems work in practice? The implementation details must be vital.
They are absolutely vital. The OECD report outlines key decisions for policymakers. It starts with robust governance structures. You need strong engagement from various government ministries, public agencies, and importantly, social partners like unions and employer groups. Then there are the digital platforms. These are really the backbone of ILA implementation. They're the operational hub, if you will.
Okay, digital platforms. So what do they do?
Well, they often serve a dual purpose. First, they act as aggregators of training opportunities, kind of like a one-stop shop for adult learning, whether using ILA funding or not. Think of platforms like France's Mon Comp Formation or Singapore's My Skills Future. They list loads of courses. But beyond just listing, they also function as the gateway to the funding itself, often facilitating the purchase of courses directly through the platform.
And how do people access these?
Typically using national digital ID systems, which is efficient because it can sometimes even automatically verify eligibility for funding, streamlining the whole process.
Okay, but how much choice do people actually get? Do the procedures vary?
They do vary, yeah, reflecting different policy goals. In some countries, like France, credit holders have almost full autonomy. They don't need public authority approval for their chosen courses. In others, like Lithuania, applications might go through automatic eligibility checks, which are pretty efficient. But then in places like Croatia or the Netherlands, a more formal approval process might still be required, although reportedly most applications are accepted. And while these online platforms are undeniably efficient, it's crucial to have alternative support channels like phone helplines or even in-person assistance for individuals who might have limited digital skills. skills. It's about bridging that digital divide.
Yeah, ensuring inclusivity.
Mm.
And crucially, how do these systems ensure the training is actually high quality and relevant? That seems like a huge potential pitfall.
It is. The reports really hammer this home. With individuals having so much autonomy in choosing courses, you absolutely need robust quality assurance mechanisms. This isn't just about preventing misuse of public funds, though that's important. It's more fundamentally about ensuring the training genuinely leads to real, tangible labor market outcomes for the learner.
So what does that look like? How do countries do quality assurance for these things?
Well, they're implementing various rigorous frameworks. France, for example, has a comprehensive certification process called Qualiopi for any training provider wanting to receive public funds. And their courses have to be directly linked to national qualification registers. Singapore uses its robust skills framework to align courses with specific industry needs, and their providers undergo pretty rigorous evaluations, including on-site visits. Even countries like Lithuania have developed specific quality assurance systems just for ILAs, particularly targeting non-formal providers who might typically have less oversight. It's about ensuring consistency.
Okay, quality assurance is key. But what about the other supports? The enabling frameworks, as the report calls them. Because just having the funds isn't enough if you, say, can't afford to take time off work, or if you don't even know what skills you should be learning. It's like having a gym membership but no workout plan, right?
Exactly. Paid training leave is a really significant enabling measure. France has a program allowing employees to take leave for specific job change training while getting income support. Lithuania offers up to 5 days of paid leave for non-formal training if it's job relevant and the employee meets certain tenure requirements. And Singapore provides something called a Skills Future Mid-Career Training Allowance, which can offer up to 50% of your monthly income for substantive full-time upskilling. That makes it financially feasible for mid-career folks to really retool.
That financial support is huge. And what about guidance? Helping people choose the right training?
That's the other massive piece of the puzzle. Career guidance. It's absolutely essential to help individuals navigate this increasingly complex training landscape, make informed choices that align with their career goals, and, importantly, with market demand. In France, you can actually use your ILA funds for a detailed skills assessment. They call it a bilan de compétences, which helps you map your existing strengths and identify growth areas. Singapore's My Skills Future portal offers self-assessment tools, and they have this feature called Careers Finder, which is powered by AI, providing personalized job recommendations and training opportunities.
Ah, AI again. So this is where we start seeing that smart training idea really come into play.
This is truly where we start to see the quiet revolution, yes. AI-powered tools can significantly enhance career guidance. They can provide data-driven insights tailored to an individual's skills and interests and match them with evolving labor market demands almost in real time. This really helps make skill building personal, adaptive, and precision-aligned. Truly smart training. And beyond guidance, AI tools are also transforming the hiring process itself.
Right, that's where it gets really transformative, isn't it? AI-powered assessments being integrated into recruitment.
Exactly. We're talking about sophisticated psychometric tests, video interview analysis that can supposedly pick up on subtle cues, even chatbot-led pre-screening to efficiently filter candidates. Employers are finding these tools can potentially make the process more evidence-based, systematic, and if designed well, maybe even reduce some human biases.
Potentially reduce bias if designed well. That's the key phrase.
It is. And that's the core of what we might call the smart training AI effect. It's not just about automation. It's about using AI as a kind of co-pilot for HR professionals. This allows them to perhaps focus more on evaluating those crucial social and emotional skills, teamwork, leadership, adaptability, the things that are notoriously hard to gauge just from a CV or traditional qualifications. Governments are even exploring this. France has a national strategy for AI use in HR within its civil service, and the UK is planning to use AI tools for public service optimization, including HR assessments.
But, like with any powerful tool, there have got to be caveats, right? Concerns.
Oh, absolutely. The reports definitely note concerns. Mm-hmm. Things like the lack of standardization in AI-generated evaluations and the ever-present issues of bias and transparency if these algorithms aren't properly designed, trained, and critically monitored. The key is ensuring these advanced tools genuinely promote equity and efficiency rather than inadvertently reinforcing existing inequalities. It's a huge responsibility.
So we need guardrails. robust guidance regulations.
Yes, exactly. We're seeing efforts like Canada's work to ensure responsible AI use in candidate assessment. They mandate disclosure when AI is used and stress that human decision-making must remain central. You can't just let the algorithm decide. And complementing this, technologies like blockchain are gaining traction for secure, verifiable digital credentials.
Blockchain for credentials. How does that work?
Well, imagine your qualifications, your micro-credentials, maybe vocational training certificates, all stored securely on a blockchain. They can be embedded with metadata, ensuring authenticity and basically preventing fraud.
Okay, so job seekers could just share these credentials easily, maybe with unique digital keys or QR codes, allowing employers to instantly verify them. That sounds like it could really streamline hiring.
It could be a massive step towards universal recognition of skills, especially those acquired outside traditional degree pathways wherever they're learned. There's the European blockchain services infrastructure, for example, being developed precisely to provide secure digital credentials recognized across all EU member states.
Wow, so that really strengthens what you call skill signaling, right?
Yeah.
Allowing people to show credible employer-recognized skills from work experience, short courses, alternative training.
Exactly. And this is vital because how individuals signal their skills is becoming more important than ever. Digital platforms like LinkedIn have become absolutely central to this shift.
It's fascinating how proactive people are becoming online. The reports mention the probability of adding skills to online profiles has, what, doubled since 2018?
Doubled, yeah. And the average number of skills people list has grown significantly, too, from around 8 to maybe 11 or 12 skills on average across OECD countries. People are actively curating their digital skill portfolios.
And what kind of skills are they signaling?
Well, specialized industry skills are still the most common, but there is a clear rise in both general tech skills and particularly what the report calls disruptive skills, those related to emerging tech like AI, robotics. They saw remarkable growth, something like 54% between 2018 and 2023. And those transversal skills we mentioned, communication, teamwork, adaptability, they're also increasingly important as employers look for well-rounded candidates.
And here's the powerful payoff, the real motivator, perhaps. The Empowering the Workforce report found that individuals who actively signal their skills actually experience shorter employment gaps.
That's right. Each additional skill listed on a platform like LinkedIn, for instance, is associated with a measurable reduction in the median time someone spends unemployed between jobs.
And here's the real aha moment for me. The biggest returns, the largest reductions in those gaps, are seen among individuals who don't have a formal education, like a degree, listed on their profiles. In fact, the very first skill added seems to have the strongest impact on reducing those gaps, regardless of your educational background.
Yeah,
that's a potential game changer.
It really is. But it begs the question then, how do we make sure individuals, especially those from maybe underrepresented groups or those with less formal education, are aware of this and supported in effectively signaling their skills? The timing matters too, apparently. Skills added while someone is unemployed tend to be more effective, and the impact varies by industry. You see higher returns for self-added skills in sectors like utilities, manufacturing, financial services, places where skills-based hiring might already be more common. It's all about making your capabilities visible, you know, in the right places at the right time.
Okay, so wrapping this up, what does this all mean for you, the listener? We've journeyed through how this skills-first economy is fundamentally reshaping the entire landscape of work and learning. It's a really profound move towards recognizing true capabilities over just traditional credentials, and it's driven by these huge forces: rapid tech change, the green transition imperative, and those shifting demographics. And we saw how individual learning accounts, ILAs, are emerging as a major policy tool to enable this, really empowering individuals to take ownership of their lifelong learning.
Yeah, and connecting it all, the reports make it crystal clear that while opening up access to learning through ILAs, through skills-first hiring is crucial. It's the quality, the relevance, and critically the support for that learning that are absolutely paramount. Without robust quality assurance for training providers, without effective and inclusive digital platforms, without comprehensive career guidance, well, even the best intentions can fall short. We also touched on the transformative, but needing careful handling, application of AI tools in skills assessment and validation, and the potential of technologies like blockchain for secure, universally verifiable credentials, really revolutionizing how skills get recognized.
And remember that really powerful insight. The very first skill you add to your profile can have the strongest impact on reducing employment gaps, especially if you don't have a formal degree. That's a clear signal, isn't it? It's really about being proactive, being crystal clear, and communicating what you know and importantly, what you can do.
Which leaves us with, I think, an important question for you, the listener. In this world that's increasingly becoming skills first, how do you proactively manage your own skill development? How do you make sure your capabilities are visible? And maybe broader than that, how can individuals and the organizations they're part of ensure that learning doesn't just happen, but that it truly translates into tangible career growth and long-term workforce resilience? Especially as we navigate all these exciting but complex new tools and the ever-evolving demands for skills, what's your next skill move going to be?